Christina Lamb now, an intrepid and veteran news correspondent, the chief foreign correspondent of the Sunday Times in the UK. She has the OBE. She's won a host of major journalism awards. In 1988, she was the UK Young Journalist of the Year for her coverage of the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, and she embedded herself for 2 years with the Mujahideen fighting the Soviets. She was thrown out of Pakistan after an investigation into rogue elements within military intelligence. She only just escaped with her life when the Taliban ambushed a British military patrol she was travelling with in Helmland. She's inspired kick-ass characters in fiction. She's written a number of books herself, especially about the struggle of women in the world. I Am Malala, the story of the girl who stood up for education and was shot by the Taliban that sold 2 million copies. Nujeen, one girl's incredible journey from war-torn Syria in a wheelchair that's been translated into 9 languages. Our Bodies, Their Battlefield, her latest book, has been featured on RNZ National already. In short, Christina Lamb is your quintessential foreign correspondent with many profound stories to tell. So it's fascinating that her latest one is about the royal family. Christina, good morning, good evening to you.
Good evening, Jim.
Nice to have you on. And the first question is obvious, really. After a career like yours so far, how on earth, on the surface of things anyway, did you come to be travelling to Africa and South Sudan, of all places, with Sophie, the Countess of Wessex? It was a royal tour of sorts.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not normally a royal correspondent, but Sophie, Countess of Wessex, who's married to Prince Edward, Queen's youngest son, is very interested in an issue that I'm very interested in, which is war rape and sexual violence in conflict. And, well, first of all, I got a mysterious message actually saying a VVIP would like to meet me to discuss the issue. Maybe even a VVVIP. So I didn't really know who it was going to be. To be honest, I was a bit skeptical at the beginning because I thought, oh, you know, she's not really that interested in the issue and she's just trying to get publicity. But in fact, when I met her the first time and she'd just come back from Sierra Leone, she was clearly very genuine about the issue. And in fact, she was in tears talking about a woman that she met there who had been raped just a few days before her visit.
How often have you been in tears? Because I imagine even with your war record and combat and danger record, it still gets to you. It must do.
Yeah, I mean, listening to some of these stories from people are absolutely heartbreaking. And you would have to have a heart of ice, I think, to not shed tears at some of the things that people tell you. So yes, quite often.
All right, so you'd established her credentials, as it were, but the risk for the two of you, because I think you travelled light, the risk in South Sudan is extreme, isn't it?
Yes. Actually, I was surprised because South Sudan was still at war. They were trying to negotiate a peace agreement, but they, to be honest, had negotiated, I think, 12 peace agreements over the last few years, and none of them had survived. So I didn't really think that the trip was likely to go ahead. I mean, this is a very violent place. 400,000 people have been killed fighting there over the last 5 or 6 years.
Yes, because this will have been the riskiest royal visit. Well, I can't remember the last one, but in decades.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, interestingly, that the only time I've ever really done a royal trip properly before was when Princess Diana went to Angola in 97, and she went in some very difficult areas, but she was not a member of the royal family anymore. I mean, she was divorced from Prince Charles, so it was sort of up to her where she went, whereas Sophie, Countess of Wessex, is very much guided by, you know, there is a sort of like trips committee apparently that agrees who can go where from the royal family, and the Foreign Office is advised or gives advice on where they should and shouldn't go. So all of these things I thought meant it was quite unlikely actually that she would go there in the end.
So like Diana, Sophie has a vocation. I mean, I suppose Harry had his veterans and Charles has his causes and they all have their interests. But this would be the first time since Diana that a royal has worn her heart on her sleeve to such an extent, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, as one of Sophie's staff said to me, this is a much grittier issue than royals normally take on. So actually going into an active war zone and a place, you know, which is very risky in every way, you know, there's no medical facility.
So how did the two of you survive it? And out of interest, how did she receive what she saw and felt? I think it was a real eye-opener to her, wasn't it?
Yes, she said to me she'd never seen anything like it because it was part of Sudan and then it became independent after a lot of fighting and some intervention from a certain George Clooney in 2011. But since then, really quite shortly afterwards, they started fighting again, and largely because actually it should be quite a wealthy country. It has oil, so there's fighting over who controls the resources. That's what it's about, really.
Sophie herself, she is relevant, isn't she? I mean, she's flown under the radar, at least in our neck of the woods, for years. But she has, I think I was reading from you, 250-odd engagements a year now.
Yeah, I was surprised because she certainly was very low profile because, when she married Edward, they quite early on in the marriage got into a lot of trouble because she got caught by somebody who was known as the fake sheikh, a reporter for a tabloid, the News of the World, who used to dress up as a sheikh and then pretend that he was, you know, working for some rich Arab and offering lucrative contracts. And so she was running a PR company at that time and thought he was some wealthy potential client and started offering rather two candid opinions about Tony Blair, who was then Prime Minister, and his wife, who I think she referred to as being absolutely horrid.
Yes, right.
And also talking about the Queen as an old dear. So all of this was recorded and appeared in the News of the World. It was known as the Sophie Tapes and was a massive embarrassment for them and the royal family. And they literally kind of disappeared from view overnight. And we heard very little of them, really, after that. She had two children. And she said to me that, you know, she found it very difficult to adjust to not having a job anymore because she'd always been a working woman. And so, of course, there were obvious parallels here between her and Meghan Markle.
Yes. And parallels earlier than that between Prince Andrew and Sarah Ferguson with those elements, you know, to her life unwittingly, because there was also the infamous topless photograph in the back of the car, which was mortifying for her too, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. And I mean, the way she was treated, actually, when you look back by the tabloid press, the sort of way that they described her and some of the descriptions were really vicious. And in fact, Prince Edward wrote to the editors complaining about how they were destroying their lives, which of course something very similar to years later Harry complaining to the papers. So there were a lot of parallels, it felt.
She was mates with Meghan. It's interesting that the firm needs Sophie now, as you put it, as the safe pair of hands.
Yeah, I think she certainly does seem to be, you know, one of the Queen's more favoured people. It's funny because of the four children, Prince Charles, Andrew, Anne, and then Edward the youngest, this is the only marriage actually that's survived, and possibly at the beginning might have been the one people didn't expect to. She, you know, did, it has to be said, it's not my area really, but some unfortunate fashion choices, whereas now she dresses very stylishly, simply, Not much makeup. It all looks very chic and sleek, as various things around the royal family have imploded. Suddenly, she does seem to be the safe pair of hands, as you put it.
From frumpy to fabulous, she's got the tabloids on her side. South Sudan, you've seen a lot of trouble spots. Did George Clooney create a country or a disaster? How much hope do you have?
You know, South Sudan is the world's newest nation. There was a lot of optimism at the beginning because it, had been decades of fighting before, so it seemed like its independence was a good thing. But unfortunately, didn't last long before various groups started fighting each other, and that's what we've seen. Unfortunately, one of the characteristics of the fighting in South Sudan has been the abduction of women and rape of women and young girls, and women often suffer most in war, but this has been particularly brutal for women.
What did the women tell Sophie when you had a series of meetings with them?
Sophie was very taken by a project we went to with men, which was to sort of try and persuade men of the importance of women. We also went to a school where girls were being given money in order to go to school. Then we had a separate meeting. That was very interesting because we sort of had a meeting with the officials who went on about what an amazing project it was. It was a British kind of funded project. And so we were told how good this project was, and it had led to lots of girls going to school. Then we had a separate meeting with a round table with some of the girls. And we heard a completely different story of how the boys stole the money from them, that their families took the money. So this money, which was supposed to be used both for their school books, but also for things like buying sanitary towels so that they could go to school during their periods, all the money was being taken, so they didn't have what it was meant for.
Inside a safe UN camp, Sophie watches women walk 6 hours a day to fetch firewood, and sometimes they are attacked. She's told, "We're so happy you're here, but we need lanterns so we can go to the latrine at night without being attacked." So they're the stories you are both hearing in Sudan. The thing is, the point of her trip, will she be able to get them latrines, for example? Christina, how much clout do royal family members have internationally in these sorts of situations?
Well, I asked her that really, and she said, sometimes she feels going to these places that the things are just overwhelming, and what could she really do? But she said, the one thing that she can do is she does have sort of convening power. Royals, people are sort of slightly fascinated by royals almost everywhere. So she can get people to come and join for a lunch or a meeting and actually listen to some of these issues in a way that other people might not be able to.
Yes, okay. I skated over the George Clooney reference, but you actually write about it, and I don't think many of us know the full story there of, because in your view, South Sudan probably wouldn't exist without his intervention.
Because he started going to Sudan when the war was going on and was sort of horrified at some of the atrocities. And he had just around that time signed the contract with Nespresso to famously promote coffee pods. So was being paid a lot of money for that, that he used basically to fund a satellite to be able to monitor the abuses and atrocities and then present them to people in Washington and lobby politicians. And that in the end led to this sort of US brokered deal for a referendum on independence in 2011.
Yeah, the power of celebrity, and also I guess we can include the royals in celebrity. Who do you think achieve more in the world, seeing as we've just mentioned George Clooney, journalists or celebrities in terms of achieving change?
goodness, I don't know how you would monitor that.
It's quite a good question, though, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, I mean, I know as a journalist covering lots of injustice around the world, sometimes it's incredibly frustrating that you report on all these terrible things that are happening and it doesn't make any difference. But sometimes a photograph, you know, makes a really shocking photograph suddenly attracts everyone's attention, or a celebrity going. And that is why I went on this trip with Sophie at the end of the day, that it's quite hard to get people to care about the issue of war rape, to get editors to want to run stories about it. But if you have gone there with a royal that we don't normally get access to, and it's an unusual royal trip, that's a way of drawing attention to the issue. So I was much more interested in the issue, as she was really, and but as a way of getting it into my newspaper and getting people to read it, I had to talk quite a lot about the royal background and why, you know, why Sophie is suddenly interesting. So I think in a way we both perhaps had the same objective from the trip. You know, we were talking a lot about the importance of getting justice for women who have been violated in war, because, you know, if there's total impunity, then it's not going to end. And so she was talking about that a lot. I think she's right. But I said to her, you know, I can't talk to you about your talking about justice for sexual abuse and sexual violence, and your brother-in-law, Prince Andrew, is being accused of being friends with a paedophile, and has in fact been accused by one of the young women of having forcibly slept with her when she was underage. So, you know, how does that square with what you're talking about? And there was a silence, really, when I asked that question. And she said that she couldn't answer it. And I said, well, I have to ask it. So, but she, you know, said she wouldn't say anything.
Yes.
I didn't expect her to say anything, of course. I didn't think she was suddenly going to start pouring her heart out about whatever she may or may not feel about her brother-in-law. But obviously it was an important question.
We're talking with foreign correspondent Christina Lam. We are in a world challenging inequality far more volubly and visibly. So after your trip, you visit her home, Bagshot Park, with its 57 rooms, including a grand billiard room with 241 wood panels carved by Indian craftsmen. And you observe that running costs must be enormous. She has to compartmentalise these disparities in her head as well, between South Sudan and Bagshot. That's an interesting contrast as well.
Well, I mean, that house or estate is massive. It's a really imposing country estate, which was built for Queen Victoria's third son, Prince Arthur. And some people say because Edward was not made a duke, he was, and Sophie was is a countess, not a duchess, in the way that Catherine and Meghan were made, and that there was some annoyance about that, and that the huge house was some recompense, because it certainly seemed grander than, for example, where Prince Andrew and Fergie lived, or, I mean, even Kensington Palace, in a way. Kensington Palace is, you know, in Kensington, in London, it's a very convenient and a beautiful place. But this is way bigger.
We've all had career setbacks. We would like to have been rewarded with real estate gifts, haven't we? But no, I'm not being I'm not being snarky. The point is, I suppose, that her status and grandeur is also, as you say, what gets the world's attention when she goes to places like South Sudan. So I understand that equation.
But it did feel very odd going, you know, having been in this really poor, you know, dusty place with nothing hardly functioning.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you're, you know, in this huge sprawling estate.
With rooms too many to count. In Our Bodies, Their Battlefield, and I don't want to discuss this at length because there's a very fine interview you did with Kim Hill that people can listen to. But you wrote that rape is the cheapest weapon known to man. You're not a fan, I assume, of preserving all the statues in the world dedicated to military heroes, Christina.
Well, this is a massive debate ongoing in this country at the moment and in some other places. I have mixed feelings about this. I mean, I think people should be reminded of issues. So to just remove the statues altogether isn't a solution necessarily. I'd like this, you know, the statues to be properly labelled with exactly what the person did, but not just get rid of it, because then that kind of wipes away the issue too. But I do feel very strongly that when we talk about war, that the statues are always of men, as if women didn't have any part to play. And actually, as somebody that has spent most of their working life reporting on conflicts, it seems to me that the most important thing in conflict is the people that are trying to keep life together and feed, educate, shelter, protect their children and elderly. And that's almost always the women. So I would like to see that recognised. But this issue of war rape, of course, is the dark side of what happens to women in war. And in my book, I talked to people in lots of different countries where this has happened on a wide scale, including Bangladesh, for example, where in the war in 1971 for independence, the Pakistani army raped as many as 200,000 Bengali women, and really horrific stories. And some of those women I talked to, and I also talked to a Bangladeshi man who was regarded as a war hero in his local area. And he said to me he felt embarrassed because he felt that these women who had suffered these terrible things should be regarded as heroes. And then he said, but you know, I get a pension and my name on a local school and all this kind of recognition, and these women have to hide away because they're ashamed or people stigmatize them for what happened. So I'd like to see statues for people like that.
Yeah, wouldn't we all? You've covered wars from, you know, Iraq to Libya, Angola to Syria. You've seen repression in Africa. You've been deeply concerned over the girls abducted by Boko Haram in Nigeria, and the Yazidi women as well, forced into sex slavery in Iraq. You were on Benazir Bhutto's bus when it was blown up in 2007. You've seen so much. Is the world getting better, or is the world descending once more into a thousand turmoils and tumults? What do you think?
Oh, there's a question. It's sad to see that even during the midst of this terrible pandemic, that countries at war continue to fight. We're seeing more fighting even than before, particularly in Afghanistan, and that is really sad to see. You know, you write these things and then it doesn't make any difference to them, and bad things keep happening to them, and they tell you. I mean, just today I was hearing from some of the women in DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, which has one of the world's highest incidence of conflict rape, that militia and police are going round raping women and girls because they're not wearing their masks for against coronavirus. It's very frustrating not to be able to do anything about that. I mean, telling people doesn't always lead to changes, unfortunately, but it's the one thing that I can do.
Yeah, no, we understand that. And it's still an important thing that you can do. What we need is a million more George Clooney cameras, but that would create a problem of its own.
But the good thing is all the, you know, my book, for example, on the war rape is some horrific stories, but it's also some incredible heroes and heroines and, you know, risking their lives to try and change things. And often, you know, one of them, for example, was a beekeeper from Aleppo who risked his life over and over again to rescue Yazidi girls. You know, one person can make a difference. And I think that's something we should all remember.
Christina, thank you so much for joining us on this.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for talking to me.
Christina Lamb.